Chapter 4, Walking the Line. According to his biographer Christopher Wren, after his discharge, Cash took an American Airlines flight back to Memphis, where he was met by his family and Vivian Liberto. According to Marshall Grant, who was working at the time as a mechanic at automobile sales at 309 Union, Cash arrived home by Greyhound bus and was met only by his brother Roy. Marshall, who worked alongside Roy, can remember that the bus was delayed by 2 hours. "When they came back, I looked up and saw them coming through this big overhead door," says Marshall. "I had a car up on a lift and was working on the back of it. They walked straight to me down the aisle and Roy said, 'Marshall, this is my brother J.R. that I told you about. J.R., this is Marshall Grant.' He said, 'Hi.' We shook hands and his next words were, 'I hear you do a little picking.' I said, 'Very little.' He sort of laughed and said, 'Me too.'" Marshall found Cash very easy to talk to and attributed this to the fact that he was so much like Roy, who he had now known for 3 years. He also knew Ray and Carrie Cash and had become a close family friend. After talking for a bit, Marshall took him across the shop to meet another mechanic who enjoyed locker room picking, Luther Perkins, a poker-faced preacher's kid from Mississippi. The three men spoke for about 15 minutes, promising to get together soon with their guitars. Whichever way he traveled back from New Jersey, Cash undisputedly met Marshall and Luther when he got to Memphis. They delayed the picking session a few weeks, though, because Cash was due to marry Vivian on August 7, 1954. Tom Liberto had finally relented and agreed, with a few conditions, to give Cash his daughter's hand. Not only would the couple have to wait at least 4 weeks before walking down the aisle, but Cash would undergo Catholic instruction to guarantee that any future children would be raised in the Catholic faith. Had Cash not complied, Vivian would have been excommunicated. That gave Cash 4 weeks to find a job in a suitable apartment. He wrote to Orville Rigdon, inviting him to be his best man. "I was broke at the time," remembers Rigdon. "I couldn't go." He then tried Ben Perea, but he had already enrolled in a college course and couldn't get the time off. In the end, the role went to his brother Roy. Roy introduced his brother to a friend in the Memphis Police Department, thinking that Cash's work in the USAF Security Service would qualify him for police work. Cash discussed the possibility, but soon realized that law enforcement wasn't his calling. The police officer in turn referred him to George Bates, president of the Home Equipment Company at 2529 Summer Avenue. Cash went to see Bates and was offered a job selling washing machines, refrigerators, and ornamental irons door-to-door. While Cash knew this job wasn't a calling, it would pay the rent. He didn't have the slick, false cheerfulness so often associated with the profession, and even worse, once he realized that a prospective client clearly didn't need or couldn't afford what he was offering, he would politely pack his catalogs and move on. The only good things about the job were that he set his own hours and traveling by car meant he could listen to all the latest record releases on the radio. The profusion of experimental music coming out of Memphis in July 1954 revolutionized 20th century popular music. People schooled in white church music, country, and pop were blending their sounds with the blues and gospel, creating a new hybrid called rock and roll. The day after Cash arrived back in Memphis, Elvis had recorded his first single, "That's All Right, Mama," in a studio a few yards away from automobile sales with Scotty Moore and bass player Bill Black. 3 days later, it was being played on Dewey Phillips' late-night radio show Red Hot and Blue. Anyone living in Memphis at this time was getting a foretaste of a music style that would very soon sweep the world. One of Cash's service buddies, Tom Weaver, had worked as an announcer on WMCA, a radio station in Corinth, Mississippi, and suggested Cash look up his former boss, John Bell, when he returned to the States. Because of their technical skills, radio operators often found it easy to get work in electronics, radio, and television. Since Corinth was only 80 miles due east of Memphis, one morning Cash decided to drive over to cold call on Bell, hoping for the offer of a position. "So one day this big, tall, gangly kid comes in," recalls Bell. "He was very inarticulate, but he wanted me to give him a job as an announcer, maybe as an apprentice. I had to be as kind as I could, but I told him that he'd never make it in this business as an announcer. Back in those days, radio was quite straight-laced. It wasn't as relaxed and down-home as it is now, and you had to be able to work controls as you spoke. He talked in a patois. He didn't use good English. I told him that he should go to a school where he could be trained. I suggested that he go to Keegan's in Memphis. Keegan's School of Broadcasting at 207 Madison Avenue offered basic instruction in radio production, complete with a certificate at the end of the course. The curriculum focused on scripting commercials, developing a presence at the microphone, and managing the desk. Students learned how to operate on air in the mock studio. Taking advantage of the GI Bill, Cash signed up for a part-time course, studying two mornings a week for 10 months. Being a radio presenter, especially a disc jockey, was a recognized way of getting into the music industry. It was a small step from playing other people's songs on disc to performing your own. Jim Reeves, for example, started as a newsreader on KGRI in Henderson, Texas, then became an announcer on KWKH in Shreveport, Louisiana, before starting his recording career. The best-known disc jockeys in Memphis became local celebrities who went on to write newspaper columns, promote concerts, manage artists, and cut records. His first priority, though, was to get married to Vivian Liberto, says Marshall Grant, and he did it. He didn't have any money, so I loaned him $50, and he went off to San Antonio. Cash married Vivian at St. Anne's Catholic Church on August 7, 1954, in the midst of a Texas heat wave. She wore traditional white lace, and with sweat popping off his brow, he stood beside her in his military uniform. He couldn't afford a suit. Her uncle, the priest from New Orleans, officiated. Following the reception on the Cascade Terrace of the St. Anthony Hotel, the couple headed back through the Ozarks to Memphis, stopping to spend their honeymoon night at a hotel in Palestine, Texas. By September 1954, the Cashes had set up house in a small, two-bedroom apartment on the second floor of a building on East Moreland Avenue. They had a private bathroom but shared the third-floor kitchen with the other tenants. The rent was $55 a month. Cash's lingering memory of it was only as hot and horrible, with no space for musical gatherings. Any guitar pull would either have to be at Luther and Bertie Perkins' home on Nathan Avenue or Marshall and Etta Grant's on Nokomis Avenue. Though both 4 years older than Cash, Luther and Marshall shared with him a country upbringing, an enjoyment of music, and a love of practical jokes. Marshall, raised in Flats, North Carolina, grew up picking cotton. Although born in Memphis, Luther had grown up in Como, Mississippi, and like Cash, they were both Southern Baptists whose first choice of songs invariably included the gospel numbers of Ira and Charlie Louvin, the Statesman Quartet, and the Blackwood Brothers, all of whom coincidentally lived in Memphis. "When we started playing, most of what we did was gospel," says Marshall. "That's what we all liked. John would sing and I would sing harmony with him. Luther didn't sing very much. Even though John has said that he wrote a song or two in Germany, he didn't bring any of them along with him. The only other stuff we did was some Ernest Tubb and some Hank Snow. In fact, when Roy had told me about his brother, he had said that he sang just like Hank Snow." The three musicians gelled right from the start, and within weeks they dropped the three-rhythm guitar line in favor of lead guitar, rhythm, and bass. Thinking ahead about playing on the radio or even making a record, they reasoned that three acoustic guitars all playing rhythm would not impress a producer. They needed more depth and breadth to their sound and elected Luther to play lead on a borrowed electric Fender. They also agreed that Cash should stick with rhythm guitar since he did most of the singing. Marshall bought a second-hand stand-up bass for $25. This division of labor and their limited playing ability produced a unique group sound. Luther's caution on the lead guitar led him to play slowly, one note at a time. To eliminate the ringing made when playing too loud, he removed the metal plate and would deaden the strings with the palm of his right hand. Cash fed paper through his strings to make his rhythm playing sound like brushes on a snare drum. Marshall, meanwhile, didn't know how to tune a bass fiddle. He asked Gene Steele, a friend who played in a band, to find out from his bass player how to do it. Steele came back from a gig with a crude pencil drawing of a guitar neck and handwritten instructions. "The bass didn't have frets, so when we had tuned it, we still didn't know the position of the notes," says Marshall. "So I had to ask Luther to give me an A, and I'd go up and down all four strings until I'd found every A note. And where I found them, I'd stick a piece of tape. Then I did the same thing for B, C, E, F, and G. My bass was full of tape when we got through, and we all just stood there and laughed and laughed. Then, jokingly, I suggested that we play something. Luther said, 'In what key?' I said, 'I don't know. Let me look at this thing a minute. E looks pretty good, but don't change no chords on me.' So they started a rhythm in E, and I started slapping the strings. So there was Luther with the palm of his hand laying on his strings, and John with his old awkward style of guitar playing, and me hitting the same notes as Luther. We didn't necessarily like the way we sounded because we wanted to sound like people with records. Missing documentary evidence and fading 50-year-old memories make it hard to pin down the precise chronology of what happened next. Everyone agrees that after about 4 months of these informal picking sessions, they played their first public performance in a Memphis church. Marshall can't remember how the invitation came to them, but Cash once said that neighbors of either Marshall or Luther heard them practicing and asked if they would be willing to play at their church. Marshall is sure that the church was on the corner of Cooper Street and Young Avenue. In a 1970 interview, he specifically mentioned Galloway United Methodist Church, which was, and still is, at this junction south of Union Avenue. They disagree, however, on the nature of the concert. In his books, Cash claimed that they played as part of a Sunday evening service, but Marshall remembers it as a midweek event, not in the main church itself, and attended only by a few elderly ladies. Two parishioners, still members of the church, claimed to remember the event.